Chapter 20. The Refuge, the Usun Colony Primary Refuge Command Center, 2553 CE, the Age of Reclamation.
How long has it been? Sitenz asked.
He asked it rhetorically because he knew full well.
Half a solar orbit at least, Baltol said gloomily. How many days was that?
Hundreds. It made Baltol sick to contemplate the situation. And he was also sickened by the break in the outer hull of Section 7. He could see it on the monitors in the command center of Primary Section. Only two of the scout eyes worked anymore, and one of them had found a breach in 7. Luckily, the meteor had struck only an air compression module, which was itself locked off from the other modules. A little atmosphere had been lost, but that meteor shouldn't have been able to break through the hull at all. There were repellent fields around the colony's hulls, only switched off when maintenance was done. Now repellent fields were beginning to fail on some sections, because they couldn't access generator repair parts in Section 2.
We should have moved everything vital to primary many cycles ago, Baltol said.
Nzerser wanted to do it, but the other section captains complained that it would leave them vulnerable, that it discounted them. It was all politics, really.
Those fields have to be repaired, Satin said. We'll have to raid, too.
They'll see us coming. Their airlock surveillance is perfectly intact there.
There are other ways to get in, Great Kaidan. It's possible to locally cancel the repellent field. We could cut our way in, without serious depressurization inside.
Baltol turned dejectedly from the screens. If we knew for a certainty what was going on inside Section 2, perhaps. But suppose we cut into an area where they've moved some of our people, the innocents. We could kill them all.
I have a system I think will reveal what's in any section area, if I can get close enough. It's an adaptation of the old scan cam system, with increased output. I have it ready for testing.
Have you?
We must attempt it, then.
Satenz, we need to know what conditions are like for everyone in those sections. Are they sick? Have they resorted to cannibalism? Does Kingsa torture those who resist him?
We know nothing for certain.
Satenz made a rueful snorting sound.
You have been subsidizing them. They are not starving.
We have exchanged food for supplies. But suppose that Kingsa and his followers are keeping the food for themselves.
They do have a protein synthesizer, which could feed everyone.
It requires a base to synthesize from. They must have come close to running out of the base materials. Baltol rubbed his eyes wearily.
I wonder how many Sangheili in those sections actually support Kingsa.
I would have expected someone to fight back against him.
There have been some bodies jettisoned from 5. You were informed of this.
Baltol grimaced.
Yes.
Do you think they took up arms against Kingsa?
It's possible.
And we had attempted defections. They're short one vessel now. Baltol had been watching on these same monitors when the shuttle had been hit by the projectile. A silent explosion in space, and 16 Usuns had been killed as the vessel turned inside out from the puncture. Kingsa's arms craftsmen had made crude space-ready missiles that had done the job. And that made invasion from Baltol's sections all the more difficult.
If only I knew, Satenz.
I should try again to transmit a message to Kingsa's sections. Encourage our people to fight him. There was a public address system he had used before all this started that transmitted from primary section to the others.
I do not think there is any doubt that he has deactivated the transmission system. At least from outside signals. And respectfully, Kaidan, words alone avail little.
10 cycles after Kingsa took over, 6 Usuns had successfully escaped Kingsa's contingent. They reported harsh privation, worsening air quality, food rations cut to minimum, martial law, enforced worship of Greftus and Kinsa himself. And there were more outbreaks of savagery from blood sickness. It would be much worse by now. "We will go, Satens. Organize a raiding party, and find the proper penetration point."
"Respectfully, my Kaidan, you cannot go along. You are too vital to the well-being of the refuge. It simply cannot be contemplated."
"I want to see for myself how things are there."
"You can trust me to report to you."
"If you survive," Baltal thought, but aloud he only made a discontented grunt of dissent. He turned again to look at the rows of monitors, and saw something a sentry had been watching to amuse himself and forgotten to take down. It was footage of a float fight tournament. There were several great float fighters competing, whirling, hurtling, hurling themselves through space, pitching headlong through zero gravity in the combat section. Combat initiated not by order of the Kaidan was never legal in the colony, but Sangheili needed conflict. The necessity of some form of combat to maintain their sanity, their identity. So over time the float fights had evolved, a sport that could be deadly, one that was always dangerous, and which gave a Sangheili, watching or taking part, a chance to satisfy that innate hunger for battle. The atmosphere in the big hemispherical zero-gravity room was already splotched with floating, warping billows of gore. It was striped with stretch lines, taut, flexible vertical bands that were used by fighters to realign their trajectory, to rebound, to swing about for an attack. The judges usually removed a fighter before he met his end. If a judge decided a competitor was too torn up from the throwing blades, the quarter moons, and the spiked gloves, then a beam of intense red light was projected onto the wounded Sangheili, and he was forced, by the rules, to curl up, to take a fetal position, which then made him extraneous to the fight. Referees would fly out, mildly propelled by jetpacks, and take him out of the competition. If he was pulled out, the audience, lined up in the straps along the walls, would hoot derisively at the fighter, or groan with sympathy if he happened to be a favorite.
There, for Erm Kurdek. The greatest surviving float fighter was rocketing through the middle of the echoing arena, slamming spiked gloves as he passed through, knocking adversaries spinning. Then he did a tuck and roll in mid-air so that his feet could propel off the netting that protected the audience, sending him back in for another flyby. It was a vicious sport, but it had been found that over the centuries, it provided the outlet that kept relative peace on the colony. At least most of the time it did. Sometimes fights broke out between sections, and now, with Kinsa, social unrest had become hostage-taking, blockades, exploding shuttles, shrieks unheard in the insulation of the primary refuge. Baltal watched the match unfold, every fighter against every other. They grabbed the stretch lines and swung about like some primeval tree beasts, coming back at their enemies. They rounded from the stretch lines and the nets. They collided. They shouted in fury and pain. On and on it went. First one, and then a second and third eliminated, until only two were left. The Float Fight Commission tried to prevent deaths, sometimes unsuccessfully. And it was not unheard of that the last two competitors might kill each other. Baltal felt a shiver down his spine. This recorded unfolding of a float fight might be a foreshadowing, with its trembling globules of blood in the air, a dire omen of what was to come to every part of the colony. The Journey's Sustenance, a supply ship for the fleet of Blessed Veneration, Usen System, 2553 CE. The Age of Reclamation. Zoreskin kept them at it, but it was becoming difficult.
Somewhere their enemies were still fighting their allies, and they were here, endlessly searching a forbidden solar system. Their vessel was not equipped with long-range scan equipment. It had not been devised for surveying. So commenced the traveling and scouring of this large system, looking for the Forgotten. They were on a treasure hunt that encompassed millions of miles, seeking out the relics that Zoe insisted would lead them to a stunningly rich reliquary. They prospected rocky moons, planets where the skies screamed with methane winds. They searched through the asteroid belt. They flew close to comets and examined them, looking for clues, finding all too much, and yet all too little. Their food supplies were close to exhaustion. So too was their patience. Arguments broke out over trivial matters. Only surface exploration of the moons, the planetoids, the asteroids, alleviated their restlessness. Time wore on. Time slipped away. But the asteroid belt was as large as the orbit of a planet halfway to the farthest reaches of this system. There was much to see, and much that was difficult to see. And chance had kept them in the wrong part of the asteroid belt, the opposite end, with the sun between them, on the plane of the ecliptic and the Usan colony. But then, the day came. Zoreskin irritably glanced up as the hatchway hissed open and Gutorik came into the pressure suit storage hold that doubled as a laboratory. "I came to look at the latest harvest from the asteroid belt," Gutorik said. They called it the harvest. They were now using a weak gravitation field to scoop in anything they found in the asteroid belt that looked artificial. "Here," Zoe muttered, taking another fragment from the scratched and dirty metal table and putting it under the down-pointing cone of the analyzer. The three-dimensional image of the twisted metal fragment expanded, slowly rotated in holographic representation over the table. There was part of an ancient, yet familiar ideogram on it. "You see that? Forerunner." "Yes. But it is the same problem. Small fragments." Gutorik nodded at the relics on the table. "A pile of rubble, really. Is it not possible that there is nothing else out there? That the explosion destroyed the construct utterly? And even if it survived a while, in 2,000 solar cycles, it might well be gone." "It has been more than 2,000 solar cycles, in fact, by quite a bit, since its purported end," Zoe said, looking at another fragment of alloy. "Odd how this material is so metallic and yet is not mere metal. We have reproduced some forerunner materials, but this may be one of their final innovations." "You were holding it with your bare hands," Gutorik noted. "You did run this harvest through the radiation cleanser."
"Yes. It takes two cleansings. It is as if someone wanted to create a great deal of toxicity around these fragments, to deliberately give the impression that there is nothing to find here but deadly rubble."
He looked at Gutorik. "You and the others want to give up the search?" After a moment's hesitation, Gutorik admitted, "It might be best, especially in light of news that is perhaps more exciting to a Sangheili than to a Sanshayum."
"And what news is that?" Zoe asked, trying to decipher the ideogram.
"Tool decoded another set of subspace communications. We have had confirmation of what came to us only as inference before. The Covenant is..." He pointed to the rubble. "Like that. In fragments. Shattered. The Flood destroyed what remained of High Charity. The Prophet of Mercy killed. The Ark shut down and the Halos silenced by the Demon. And the Prophet of Truth dead at the hands of Thel Vadami. May the Great Ones bless him for it." Zoe set a fragment aside and selected another.
"So, McKen's Greyabin's prophecy was correct. At last, The Covenant has met its end. Earlier reports indicated that the elites had actually joined the humans. It is true, Gatorik mused. The humans claimed that the rings were not a means to achieve the great journey, but instead weapons of mass destruction, used by the Forerunners to purge the galaxy of all sentient life, cutting off the flood from any source of continuation. Zoe sighed, wrestling with the paradigm shift, but feeling the weight of its truth. My ancestor theorized as much. In secret, of course, based on evidence he had gathered from his time on Jonjer Com. Whether they were gods or not, it appears that the Forerunners were victims of their own design, committing themselves to self-annihilation for the sake of preserving sentient life throughout the galaxy. His thoughts lightly nudged the intriguing parallel between the Forerunners and the Usans. Both committed themselves to an end rather than surrender to their enemies. Both appeared to have vanished from the face of the galaxy. There is more. The Sangheili who once served the Covenant in the fleets are now beginning to return to Sanghelios and its colonies. It is a mixing of blood, however. Many still regard the Forerunners as holy and hold to some form of the path. Others believe they were only just another race, brilliant beyond measure, but merely mortal. The Arbiter is being held by his people as the newly fledged leader of those who have truly abandoned the Covenant. They hope to lay claim to the spirit of Sanghelios, keep by keep.
Indeed.
Zoe looked over at Gatorik. He could see exultation in his friend's body language and the sparkle of his eyes.
So, you and the others here have a homeworld to return to.
I am glad of that, Gatorik. And, he thought, I'm a bit envious. Why not come with us to Sanghelios? High Charity is gone. There is no place left for you now. We do not even know where the surviving prophets went, if any survived to begin with.
Ah, to be the only one of my kind on a planet with countless natives who now thoroughly hate the Sanshayum?
It doesn't seem wise. No new writ of union in my future, I'm afraid. Zoe felt as if the room's gravitation was increasing.
Is there anything amiss with the grav fields?
No. I feel nothing out of the ordinary. He let out a long breath and slumped back into a chair. It was not an anti-grav chair. He had only his belt now.
When I think of the other Sanshayum, I feel heavy. As if...
He grimaced, remembering the Sangheili captives flattened, crushed by exquisite devotion in the gravitational refinement chamber. The horrifying memory never left him for long. He felt somehow that it had aged him before his time. He revisited that place in his nightmares.
Your people are out there somewhere, Zoe, said Gatorik, as gently as a Sangheili knew how. Some must have survived. I am sure of it. But until you find them, you should come with us to Sanghelios.
I will consider it, perhaps. But I have not given up here yet. We have been searching for much of a solar cycle. We've found nothing but space trash.
But you have forgotten the accounts D'Aero turned up, the logs of other captains who had spoken to Kigyar pirates. They came upon larger artifacts in this system. One of them claimed that something in this asteroid belt had actually fired upon them.
The Kigyar, Gatorik sniffed. Who can trust their word?
Mackenzie Greyaben suspected that the colony may have survived, may have used the explosion from long ago as camouflage. Put that together with the Kigyar tales.
Tool came in then, with the Huragok, sluggish drifter, trailing after him. The Huragok was like some weightless Nelosh, an aquatic animal from his ancestors' records of Jonjer Com, floating through the air, its long neck twitching,
its coils whipping out, tendrils seeking here and there. It signaled to Tool, who said, "Sluggish asks if it can repair some of these items." He pointed at the wreckage on the table.
"These, I fear, are beyond repair, even by a Hurricock," so observed sadly.
He sat back in the chair and adjusted his anti-grav belt to remove a point or two of his weight. But it didn't help much. The pressure was all in his mind.
"Maybe I should journey with you to Sanghelios.
If you really believe I will not be summarily executed there upon our arrival."
"You will be under our protection," Tool said.
"When we tell them our story, you may even be revered there." Zo grunted skeptically. "If the rest of you do not wish to continue the search, then I cannot insist. I have no authority here, and Sanghelios would be one of my very few options."
He looked at the twisted, blackened bits of machinery piled on the table.
"I had hoped to find something else among asteroids and debris, something that might connect me with my ancestor, the prophet of inner conviction."
He often lamented about the failings of his own people, as have I.
"And it seemed that we were brought here by sheer fate."
He refused to admit to himself that he might well be the last living San Shayun.
De'Aero's voice crackled from a comm grid on the wall.
"Zo Reskin, there is something up here you will want to see. Come to the bridge."
Suddenly the excess weight lifted away from Zo and he sprang to his feet, moved quickly past Tool and Gatorik, and almost collided with the Hurricock, which just managed to jet out of his way. Soon he was entering the bridge of the journey's sustenance.
"De'Aero, you called and I have come."
Tool, Gatorik, and the Hurricock had followed, arriving a few moments later, as Zo sat down in the co-pilot seat beside De'Aero.
"There," grumbled the captain.
He pointed at the holoscope, which showed a three-dimensional view of a crowded section of the asteroid belt. Great whirling stones, some rimed with ice, tumbled past one another. The light was stark, coming from the sun on one side. The dark sides of each asteroid were inky black.
"What am I to see here?" Zo asked, puzzled.
De'Aero tapped at the scope's controls and the image magnified, zooming in. Still Zo saw nothing, until two gigantic, ragged-edged chunks of rock rolled out of the way, revealing a sharp-edged, silvery object. Clearly it was artificial, its shape odd and yet organized. It was forged material at a glance, like the fragments piled on the table, but it was much larger than any artificial object they had encountered in the asteroid belt, and even the journey's sustenance. The object remained relatively stable, not spinning like those around it, and along its surface was a shimmering coat of force.
"Incredible," Zo said breathlessly.
"We were here all this time, and it still managed to avoid detection."
"It is operational, judging from the force field," Tool said, looking over his shoulder.
"And someone has kept it that way.
So, we may have just stumbled upon the Usan colony."
"Are we truly going there?" De'Aero asked. "Because chances are they will not be friendly to intruders. If we reveal ourselves, we may not receive a warm reception. We may have to fight for our lives."